Americana. I believe that we are lost here in America, but I believe we shall be found. I think the true discovery of America is before us. I think the true fulfillment of our spirit, of our people, of our mighty and immortal land is yet to come. I think the true discovery of our own democracy is still before us, and I think that all these things are as certain as the morning, as inevitable as noon. I think I speak for most men living when I say that our America is here, is now, and beckons on before us, and that this glorious assurance is not only our dream to be accomplished, but our living hope.
The words you have just heard were written by Thomas Wolfe in his novel, You Can't Go Home Again. This program is Americana, the 24th in a series of radio essays on the American scene, presented each week by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Tonight, we bring you Thomas Wolfe's America.
Good evening. I'm Martin Maloney of the School of Speech at Northwestern University. Some weeks ago, when in the course of talking about trains and railroading, we had quoted one of Thomas Wolfe's great pieces of rhetoric on that subject, I had a letter from a lady who asked some questions about Wolfe. What books had he written besides Of Time and the River? And had anything ever been written about his life? And was he really, as she had heard, a desperately lonely man? The letter reminded me that I have intended for a long time to devote one of these programs entirely to Wolfe. There are few American writers more appropriate to our theme. The most revealing thing that you can say about Thomas Wolfe is that he was American. In his life and his works, he showed all the defects and all the virtues of the American. He was at once the critic and the thing criticized, the historian and the event. And yes, he was a lonely man.
Thomas Wolfe, American novelist and short story writer. Wolfe was born in Asheville, North Carolina, in 1901. He was educated at the University of North Carolina, where he became interested in playwriting, and at Harvard, where he studied under the late George Pierce Baker. A play which he wrote during this period was seriously considered for production by the Theater Guild, but was eventually rejected. After leaving Harvard, Wolfe taught for some time at New York University. In 1929, his first novel, Look Homeward, Angel, was published. He continued to write and eventually was able to devote all his time to this pursuit. He published in 1935 a second novel, Of Time and the River, and a collection of short pieces entitled From Death to Morning. In 1936, he published a short book dealing with his methods as a writer, The Story of a Novel. He died September 15, 1938. He left behind an enormous collection of miscellaneous manuscripts amounting to over 1 million words. From this manuscript, his publishers edited 2 complete novels, The Web and the Rock and You Can't Go Home Again, plus a partially completed novel, The Hills Beyond.
This is the barest of biographical sketches, and of course it really explains nothing. Yet perhaps you might realize, even from this brief sketch, that Wolfe's books were extraordinary. They seem to have been, for the most part, autobiographical in an almost literal sense. The hero of the first 2 novels is Eugene Gant, a huge, frenzied fellow who had an insane passion to walk 1 million streets, read 1 million books, make love to 1 million women, to eat, see, know, feel everything under the sun. The hero of the 2 posthumous novels is a huge, frenzied fellow named George Weber, who is at least a blood brother to Eugene Gant, and who, like Eugene, is scarcely to be distinguished from Wolfe himself. The novels are vast, sprawling works which some critics have called formless. This epithet, however, is not really correct. The books taken together have a form, the structure of Wolfe's own experience as he was able to relive it. Wolfe's method of writing these works is revealing. He was an energetic and fertile writer, and he was gifted with an extraordinary memory. It was apparently not his practice to plan his novels as novels. He thought in terms of a single work, which was to stretch over several thousands of printed pages, over several generations of human experience, and to include in its cast some thousands of characters. Actually, a great deal of the writing that he published grew out of his own immediate experience and recollections. Since he was his own hero, since the incidents of his tale depended on what he could remember and dramatize, he was free to range the whole period of his life, writing today what had happened last week, and tomorrow an event which took place 20 years ago. When he had thus accumulated a huge mass of manuscript, he sorted it out in chronological sequence, and lo, he had a novel. The preparation of the book of Time and the River was accomplished in this fashion, with constant advice and aid of the great Scribner's editor, Maxwell Perkins. In the case of The Web and the Rock and You Can't Go Home Again, this sorting, weaving task was accomplished by the Harper's editor, Edward Aswell. These books were tremendous in their scope, violent and turbulent in their tone. The critics, as late as 1935, when Of Time and the River appeared, didn't quite know what to make of them, so they wrote their criticisms largely in terms of their professional habits. Mr. Bernard DeVoto, in an essay called Genius Is Not Enough, displayed his usual combination of common sense and cantankerousness.
For the truth is that Mr. Wolfe is presented to us and to himself as a genius. And what is more, a genius of the good old-fashioned kind, possessed by a demon, driven by the gales of his own fury, helpless before the lava flood of his own passion, selected and set apart for greatness, his lips touched by a live coal, consequently unable to exercise any control over what he does, and in fact likely to be damaged or diminished by any effort of control. Genius is everything. If you have enough of it in you, you can make a world. Yes, but what if you don't make a world? What if you just make a noise?
Edward Aswell, Wolfe's second and last editor, of course, thought very differently about the novels. They were not chaotic or formless, he said, as some critics had charged. It was just that Wolfe saw too clearly and saw too much.
Disillusionment, the hindsight of the self-deluded and the half-blind, was not one of Thomas Wolfe's qualities. No one ever accused him of being blind in any degree. His fault, if fault it was that he saw too much. Till the day he died, he retained that luminous gift which all bright children seem to possess up to a certain age. The ability to look at life and see it as it really is, with its many and ever-changing faces, its mystery and wonder, its exhilaration and stark terror, its endless contrasts of beauty and ugliness, its haunting interplay of good and evil, its flashing colors and subtly shifting shadows. Somewhere along the way, as we grow up, most of us lose that gift. There comes a time, some nameless day and hour, which we are not aware of, when what passes as education pulls us in, and in our hearts all unknowing, we accept things as we are told they are, and learn to conform. Somehow, and just how it happened remains a mystery of genius, Thomas Wolfe acquired an education without acquiring blinders.
But it's hardly our business at this late date to try to decide whether Wolfe was a great genius, a crippled genius, or a fake. I urge you to read his books for yourself if you've not already done so, and then decide. And if you want to know something about Wolfe's biography, what his friends and enemies, critics and editors said about him, you can do no better than to read a recent collection called The Enigma of Thomas Wolfe, which has been edited by Richard Walzer and published by the Harvard University Press. It's rather Wolfe's vision of America with which we shall be concerned here. For, of course, an American novelist, as concerned as Wolfe was with translating his experience into words, with translating all of experience into words, could hardly fail to produce an extensive and remarkable portrait of his native land. What was the nature of Thomas Wolfe's America? The shape, the form, the pattern of it was fixed, I think, by an expedient which has served many another American artist. To understand his native land, Wolfe had to leave it. The extraordinary stimulus which this experience gave to his memory and his imagination, Wolfe described, temperately enough for him, in his The Story of a Novel.
The quality of my memory is characterized, I believe, in a more than ordinary degree by the intensity of its sense impressions, its power to evoke and bring back the odors, sounds, colors, shapes, and feel of things with concrete vividness. Now, my memory was at work night and day in a way that at first I could neither check nor control, and that swarmed unbidden in a stream of blazing pageantry across my mind with a million forms and substances of the life that I had led, which was my own America. I would be sitting, for example, on the terrace of a café, watching the flash and play of life before me in the Avenue de l'Opéra, and suddenly I would remember the iron railing that goes along the boardwalk at Atlantic City. I could see it instantly, just the way it was. The heavy iron pipe, its raw galvanized look, the way the joints were fitted together. It was all so vivid and concrete that I could feel my hand upon it and know the exact dimensions, size, and shape. Suddenly, I'd realized that I'd never seen any railing that looked like this in all of Europe. And this utterly familiar, common thing would be revealed to me with all the wonder with which we discover a thing which we've seen all our lives and yet have never known before.
In his novel Of Time and the River, Wolfe used this experience in a much more rhapsodic way to suggest the nature of the America that he thus envisioned.
At morning in a foreign land, whether upon the mournful plains of Hungary or in some quiet square of Georgian houses, embedded in the immensity of sleeping London, he awakes and thinks of home. Or in some small provincial town of France, he starts up from his sleep at night. He starts up in the living, brooding stillness of the night, for suddenly he thinks that he has heard there the sounds of America and the wilderness, the things that are in his blood, in his heart, his brain, in every atom of his flesh and tissue, the things for which he draws his breath in labor, the things that madden him with an intolerable and nameless pain. And what are they? They are the whistle wail of one of the great American engines as it thunders through the continent at night, the sound of the voices of the city streets, those hard, loud, slangy voices, full of violence, humor, and recklessness, now stronger and more remote than the sounds of Asia. The sounds that come up from the harbor of Manhattan in the night. That magnificent and thrilling music of escape, mystery and joy with the mighty orchestration of the transatlantics, the hoarse little tugs, the ferry boats and lighters. Those sounds that well up from the gulf and dark immensity of the night and that pierce the entrails of the listener. For this will always be one of the immortal and living things about the land. This will be an eternal and unchanging fact about that city whose only permanence is change. There will always be the great rivers flowing around it in the darkness, the rivers that have bounded so many nameless lives, those rivers which have moated in so many changes, which have girdled the wilderness in so much hard, brilliant, and sensational living. So much pain, beauty, ugliness, so much lust, murder, corruption, love, and wild excellency. They'll build great engines yet, and grander towers, but always the rivers run in the day, in the night, in the dark, draining immensely their imperial tides out of the wilderness, washing and flowing by the coasts of the fabulous city, by all the little ticking sounds of time, by all the million lives and deaths of the city. Always the rivers run, and always there will be great ships upon the tide. Always great horns are baying at the harbor's mouth, and in the night 1,000 men have died, while the river, always the river, the dark eternal river, full of strange secret time, washing the city's stains away, thickened and darkened by its dumpings, is flowing by us to the sea. He awakes at morning in a foreign land, and he thinks of home. He cannot rest. His heart is wild with pain and loneliness. He sleeps, but then he knows he sleeps. He hears the dark and secret spell of time about him. In ancient towns, thick tumbling chimes of the cathedral bells are thronging through the dark. But through the passages of his diseased and unforgetful sleep, the sounds and memory of America make way. Now it is almost dawn. A horse had turned into a street. And in America, there is the sound of wheels, the lonely clop-clop of the hooves upon deserted pavements. Silence. Then the banging clatter of a can. The years are walking in his brain. His father's voice is sounding in his ears, and the pulses of his blood, the tom-toms beat. His living dust is stored with memory. 200 million men are walking in his bones. He hears the howling of the wind around forgotten eaves. He cannot sleep. He walks in midnight corridors. He sees the wilderness, the moon-drenched forests. He comes to clearings in the moonlit stubble. He is lost. He has never been here yet,
But he is at home. His sleep is haunted with the dreams of time. Wires throb above him in the whiteness. They make a humming in the noonday heat. The rails are laid across 800 miles of golden wheat. The rails are wound through mountains. They curve through clay-yellow cuts. They enter tunnels. They are built up across the marshes. They hug the cliff and follow by the river's bank. They cross the plains with dust and thunder. And they leap through flatness and the dull scrub pine to meet the sea. Then he awakes at morning in a foreign land and thinks of home.
Wolf's vision of America was a sensuous one. He knew his country by ear, by smell, by touch, and by sight. America, to him, really was the smell of loading wharves beside the sea, the texture of the light that he remembered upon the great city. But the meaning of America to Wolf was enfigured in a single image, an image of loneliness and movement and vastness, the image of a train which passes through a little town by night.
The train slides by the darkened, vacant-looking little station. And for a moment, one has a glimpse of the town's chief square and the business center. And as he sees it, he is filled again with the same feeling of loneliness, instant familiarity and departure. The square is one of those anomalous, shabby, ornate, inept, and pitiful, pretentious places that one finds in little towns like these. But once seen, if only for this fraction of a moment from the windows of a train, the memory of it will haunt one forever after. And this haunting and lonely memory is due probably to the combination of two things. The ghastly imitation of swarming life and metropolitan gaiety in the scene, and the almost total absence of life itself. The impression one gets, in fact, from that brief vision is one of frozen, cataleptic silence in a world from which all life has recently been extinguished by some appalling catastrophe. Beyond the station, parked in a line against the curb, is a row of empty motor cars. And one knows instantly that they've been left there by the patrons of the little moving picture theater, which explodes out of the cataleptic silence of the left-hand side of the square into a blaze of hard white and flaming posters, which seem to cover the entire facade. Even here, no movement of life is visible. But one who knows towns like these feels for the first time an emotion of warmth and life as he looks at the gaudy, blazing, bilby-plastered silence of that front. For suddenly, he seems to see the bluish blaze of carbon light that comes from the small slit-like vent hole cut into the wall and can hear again one of the loneliest and most haunting of all sounds, the rapid shuttering sound of the projection camera late at night, a sound lonely, hurried, unforgettable, coming out into those cataleptic squares of silence in the little towns as if the operator is fairly racing through the last performance of the night like a weary and exhausted creature whose stale, ever-driven life can find no joy in what is giving so much joy to others, and who is pressing desperately ahead toward the merciful rewards of food, sleep, and oblivion, which are already almost in his grasp. And as he remembers this, he also suddenly sees and knows the people in the theater, and in that instant greets them, feels his lonely kinship with them, with the whole family of the earth, and says farewell. Small, dark, lonely, silent, thirsty, and insatiate, the people of the little town are gathered there in that one small cell of radiance, warmth, and joy. There, for a little space, they are united by the magic spell the theater casts upon them. They are all dark and silent, leaning forward like a single mind and congeries of life, and yet they are all separate, too. Yes, lonely, silent, for a moment beautiful. He knows the people of the town are there, lifting the small white petals of their faces, thirsty and insatiate to that magic screen. Now they laugh exultantly as their hero triumphs, weep quietly as the mother dies. The little boys cheer wildly as the rascal gets his due. They're all there in darkness, under immense, immortal skies of time. Small, nameless creatures in a lost town on the mighty continent. And for an instant, we have seen them, known them, and said farewell.
Of course, everyone knows. Surely everyone must know by this time the great rhetoric of Wolfe's America, the nostalgic music of his past-evoking spinet, the thunder of his chant of American names, and above all else, the half-mystic and yet curiously plain and sober words with which he addressed himself to the American future. But let us hear them again. These are, I think, words which have so far worn very well.
Play us a tune and an unbroken spinet, and let the bells ring, let the bells ring. Play music now. Play us a tune and an unbroken spinet. Do not make echoes of forgotten time. Do not strike music from old, broken keys. Do not make ghosts with faded tinklings on the yellowed board. But play us a tune and an unbroken spinet. Play lively music when the instrument was new. Let us see Mozart playing in the parlor, and let us hear the sound of the ladies' voices. But more than that, waken the turmoil of forgotten streets. Let us hear their sounds again, unmuted and unchanged by time. Throw the light of Wednesday morning on the Third Crusade, and let us see Athens on an average day. Let us hear the sound of the voices of the Greeks, and observe closely if they were all wise and beautiful at 10 o'clock in the morning. Let us see if their limbs were all perfect and their gestures grave and stately. Also, let us smell their food and observe them eating and hear, if only once, the sound of a wheel in the street, the texture of just 4 forgotten moments. But there are times that are stranger yet. There are times that are stranger than the young knights and the horses and the sounds of the eating taverns. The far time is the time of yesterday. It is the time of early America. It is the voices of the people on Broadway in 1841. It is the sounds of the streets in Des Moines in 1887. It's the engines of the early trains at Baltimore in 1853. It is the faces and voices of the early American people who are lapped up in the wilderness, who are hidden from us, whose faces are in mystery, whose lives are more dark and strange than the lives of the Saxon thanes. The time that is lovely is the time of the fatness and of the bright colors. It is the elfin time of the calendars and the sad, mysterious time of the early photographs. It's the time of the early lithographs. It's a time when the world was green and red and yellow. It's the time of the red barn and the windmill and the house of the 7,000 gables. It's the time of the green lawn and the blue sky and the white excursion steamer in the river and the flag, the gay brown and white buntings, the brass bands, and the tumult of all the people who cry out, "Hooray! Hooray!" It's the time of the lightning rod salesman and the summer boarder, the time of Abner Hayseed and of Dusty Rhodes, the tramp. It's the time when boys started on a downward path through cigarettes. It's a lovely time. It's the time of the opera and the theater parties and the horse show and of late jolly suppers in the walnut dining rooms. The time of elegant ladies with long gloves on naked arms and Welsh rarebit in the chafing dish. It's the time of the 400, the great names of the millionaires, the Vanderbilts, the Astors, the Goulds. The time of the powdered flunkies and the $20 favors. It's the time of Newport and the canopied gilt and plush marble halls, and the time of the fortune-hunting foreign noblemen. It is the time of the wharves and the tangled shipping, the horse cars by the docks, of piled-up casks and kegs of rum and molasses. There are forgotten fume flaws of bright smoke above Manhattan. Where are the lost faces that came toward us over Brooklyn Bridge? Where are the parted ripples and the proud, forgotten ships?
Of wandering forever and the earth again. Brother, for what? For what? For the wilderness, the immense and lonely land. For the unendurable hunger, the unbearable ache, the incurable loneliness. For something under our feet and around us and over us. Something that is in us and part of us and proceeds from us. That beats in all the pulses of our blood. Brother, for what? By the waters of life, by time. The names of the mighty rivers, the alluvial gluts, the drains of the continent, the throats that drink America, the names of the earth that abide forever, the names of the men who are doomed to wander, and the name of that immense and lonely land on which they wander, to which they return, in which they will be buried, America. The immortal earth which waits forever, the trains that thunder on the continent, the men who wander, and the women who cry out, return.
I believe that we are lost here in America, but I believe we shall be found. I think the true discovery of America is before us. I think the true fulfillment of our spirit, of our people, of our mighty and immortal land is yet to come. I think the true discovery of our own democracy is still before us. And I think that all these things are as certain as the morning, as inevitable as noon. I think I speak for most men living when I say that our America is here, is now, and beckons on before us, and that this glorious assurance is not only our dream to be accomplished, but our living hope.
You have been listening to Americana, the 24th in a series of radio essays dealing with American history and American living, presented each week by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Americana is written and narrated by Martin Maloney. Direction is by Ralph Knowles. The quoted materials were read by Claire Baum and myself, Bill Grisky. Of Thomas Wolfe's major works, Look Homeward, Angel, of Time and the River, The Story of a Novel, and From Death to Morning, were published originally by Charles Scribner's Sons. The Web and the Rock, You Can't Go Home Again, and The Hills Beyond were published by Harper and Brothers. These works have subsequently appeared in various reprint editions. Richard Walzer's The Enigma of Thomas Wolfe is published by the Harvard University Press. If you wish to receive a list of the books discussed on this program, please send your name and address on a postcard to Americana, care of the School of Speech, Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois, and a free copy will be sent to you. This is the NBC Radio Network.